I'm Lillian Vasquez with Lifestyles on KVCR. Thanks for listening. On today's show, I'll speak with Dr. Guyani Da Silva, the Behavioral Health Medical Director for IEHP, the Inland Empire Health Plan. This interview recently aired on our program, Inland Edition. I wanted to revisit this topic because May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and it's important to monitor our mental well-being, especially during these unprecedented times. Dr. Da Silva talks about symptoms of mental health, where we can go for help, and what we can do at home to take care of ourselves. Then later in the show, I'll speak with Julie Reintz, a mother and environmental scientist who started an eco-friendly soap business to address the needs of people with sensitive skin. And now, my conversation with Dr. Da Silva, Behavioral Health Medical Director for IEHP. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Lillian. I'm glad to be with you.
You know, mental health is an ongoing issue in everyday life. Now with COVID-19 in our world, what are we seeing manifest during this pandemic with regards to mental health?
Well, you know, mental health historically has been kind of stigmatized and marginalized. But now more and more people are contending with mental health issues because we are all stuck in this crisis of COVID-19. So I'm seeing a lot of people who have never before really considered their mental health or thought about depression or anxiety, and now they're feeling lonely and controlled and helpless and hopeless, and they're beginning to feel sad. That's persistent. You know, clinical depression is a constellation of physical and emotional symptoms that persist for a week or so. Sadness, insomnia, loss of appetite, lethargy, loss of interest in things that were pleasurable before, lack of motivation, poor concentration, feelings of guilt. And they're also feeling anxious because there's so much that we don't know about COVID-19 and the course of illness and who is most at risk. So there's so much unknown that creates a lot of anxiety too in many people.
When we talk about mental health, what issues actually fall into this bucket? What other categories fall into mental health?
Mental health is so broad, you know, and there's a continuum of symptoms. So it can be very mild symptoms like occasional sadness or occasional anxiety. And then it can get even worse to mood disorders like bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, social phobia, obsessive-compulsive disorder. All of these are part of the constellation of anxiety symptoms. And then you could also have schizophrenia, which a lot of people associate with people who are homeless, you know, who hear voices and see things, have hallucinations and have paranoia. But schizophrenia can afflict anybody. So mental health illness can affect people's lives in very devastating ways. But with treatment, mental illness, mental health can be quite well managed.
All right. So let's talk about specifically, I think you mentioned some of them, specifically the symptoms that we're seeing, isolation and not really knowing what COVID-19 is. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. So this kind of prolonged state of being socially isolated can be quite traumatic for many people. Actually, it can be traumatic for everybody because this is not a usual state of being for humans.
Right.
Humans are typically quite social. We need social interaction. We crave it. We seek it. Even introverts need that social interaction. And actually, you know, I know that you do some work with kids who are on the spectrum of autism and other developmental disabilities. And sometimes we think of those kids as being in their own world, but actually they also need social interaction and they need to be accepted. So in this climate of social isolation, it becomes very complicated for people and they get prone to and vulnerable to getting quite depressed and anxious. And we have already seen people who are on the front lines and not on the front lines committing suicide. You know, they're in the media quite a lot and it's devastating. The healthcare workers who are on the front lines are working. They're basically burning the candle at both ends, right? They're trying to protect their families and they're taking care of their families. Plus they're taking care of other families and they're seeing devastating results and devastating scenarios. And unfortunately, we have seen some suicides from that as well. So when people are not taking care of their own mental health, their own needs, their emotional needs, their nurturance needs for kindness from other people and from themselves and time to rest and sleep and eat properly and exercise. When you're not getting that, then you become quite vulnerable to having a mood disorder like depression or anxiety.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Dr. De Silva. She is the medical director of behavior health for IEHP. So now that you've said some of those things, and if meds or getting into a physician right at this point is not an option, or maybe it is, I don't know. But what are some of the things we can do, or what are some of the ways to combat this? What are you suggesting?
So luckily, people can see their psychiatrist or their mental health provider and their therapist, and new patients can be established with psychiatry and with therapy.
Okay.
And this may not be done in person, but many clinics have switched over to telepsychiatry. I want to encourage everybody, if they need assistance, to get assistance earlier rather than later and make those phone calls and get an appointment. You can be evaluated over the phone or via a video. New technology for a lot of people, those of us in the business of taking care of patients, we like to see people in person, but we all have to make do, and providers are adapting to this situation. So there is help out there. People can prescribe medication. They can talk to you. They can get you into see therapy. You can have an hour, 45 minutes to an hour session with a therapist. It is covered by insurance. It's been mandated at the state level, at least, and federal, that this kind of telephonic assessment and medication prescribing is allowed and it's appropriate. So there's definitely help out there.
Now, you are talking about a medical way to help some of these individuals, but is there things at home that we can do? Is just going outside and sitting in our backyard and getting sunshine, or, I'm not a professional, but can you share things that we can try?
Absolutely. So the first thing to do is to be aware that your mental health is important, and that your mental health is tied into your general wellness. And so whatever makes you feel well, do. And whereas before a crisis situation, we may have taken care of ourselves every other day or every third day or once a week, we really need to do it every day now. Go outside, get some sun, put your feet in the grass, take a little walk around your neighborhood, get 20 minutes of exercise, helps get the blood flowing, helps your whole body, be healthy and your mind clear. Take time out of the day to just rest and tend to your own needs. Do the usual stuff. Have a nice little routine for yourself. Get up, brush your teeth, wash your face, take a shower, get dressed, have breakfast. Nutrition is very important. All the basics are super important because that's going to lay the foundation for resiliency and for your overall wellness. Sleep at a regular time. Don't get too stressed out about sleep. Sleep is a little funny. If we put too much pressure on ourselves, anticipate a good night's sleep. Know that it's important for you. That helps maintain your stress levels and your stress hormones, because cortisol decreases at nighttime and peaks during the day. Cortisol is a stress hormone, and it also affects our immune system. So if we stay up too late, then cortisol doesn't come down. It stays up and continues to suppress your immune system. And this is a time when we really need our immune system to be at its top shape.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
What age group are we seeing taking the biggest toll, or is it spread out evenly in all ages?
It's different in all ages. In children, the change is, and we're talking neurotypic children right now, the neurotypic children, they have a loss of their schedule and their social network. The academics, actually, people are talking a lot about kids losing traction in their academics, but that's not really the main issue. They'll catch up in their academics.
Right.
But the issue really is their social and brain development, problem-solving development, their mental health development of being able to manage relationships, difficulties in dynamics, and manage their emotions. So parents really need to kind of pay attention to that part. The academics will come, in a few months. That's not a big deal.
What about your tweens or your teens?
Tweens and teens, even more so, because, parents are quite influential to children until about the age of 11. And then from 11 on, their friends and social networks become much more influential. Not that parents aren't important. They are important.
Of course.
But it's really going to be important for parents to help them develop those social networks and stay in contact with their friends, maybe encourage them to do a Zoom meeting or encourage them to participate in their Zoom classrooms, encourage them to talk to their friends and maintaining social distancing appropriately and being safe, but having that conversation.
And what about our seniors, the 55 plus?
Oh, yeah. You know, when this whole thing started, I was so worried about our seniors, because seniors already are at one of the highest risk groups for suicide and suicidal ideation, loneliness and depression. You know, seniors are quite vulnerable, and to be so isolated right now is a huge concern. So I'm really glad that people are reaching out to their loved ones who are in nursing homes and having FaceTime conversations with their parents every day kind of thing. I strongly encourage that. I think that that is going to help. And just asking, oh, how are you feeling every day? And what do you need? And how can I be more helpful to you and more involved with you? Maybe interacting with them a couple times a day instead of just once a day. We've got to just drastically increase our level of reaching out to our elderly populations.
Now, you did touch on, and you know I'm going to ask this, but what about our special needs, our Down syndrome, and of course those with autism? Are they feeling it as well? Sometimes people think that, you know, they don't process any of that or they don't feel any of that. Where are you on that?
Everyone regresses during a crisis. Adults regress and children. And kids who have some developmental difficulties will also regress a bit. So we have to expect that any kind of developmental process that they struggle with, they're going to struggle even more with that. They've lost their schedule. And for kids who are on the spectrum, that's very difficult to deal with, any kind of change to their schedule. So what I am offering to my parents and suggesting is that they get a whiteboard or a big piece of white paper and write out very clearly what the schedule is going to be for the day, and then touch base to that schedule several times through the day so that the child is aware that there is a structure to their day. And it's a new structure, but they will get used to the structure that you create for them. And using a lot more sensory tools like a weighted blanket or fidget tools for their fingers, those are very helpful also for these kids.
What about our young adults with special needs? And maybe with autism, you often find they don't have any language, so you can't really ask them how they're feeling. But what's your coping methods for young adults, or maybe adults with autism or Downs that are, and Downs are tend to be very sociable?
So the caregivers who are with these folks need to be very patient with them and explain, maybe be a little more indulgent in the things that they need and be creative in some of the ideas that they might get fixated on. Allow for more of that. So I really think like a little pullback in being rigid about learning or behaving in certain ways or behaving in what might be quote unquote appropriate ways. Just kind of pull back on that a bit. Let the person guide the caregiver with what they might need in that moment.
And lastly, what is your greatest takeaway? What do you want listeners to know regarding mental health or as we live in this COVID-19 world right now?
I would like people to realize that mental health is something that every single person has a vulnerability towards, and that we need to pay attention to our mental health every day. Our health is not present without focusing on mental health as well. So that's the big takeaway, that we all are the same. We're all in this together for sure, and we are all in it together with mental health too. We can no longer stigmatize and marginalize people who have mental health issues or mental illness, because really we all contend with this every day.
Dr. De Silva, thank you very much for your time. It's been interesting listening to your input and all that you have to say. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you, Lillian, so much for having me.
To learn more about IEHP, visit our website at kvcinews.org/lifestyles and click on today's show. After a quick break, I'll speak with Julie Reince, environmental scientist and founder of Dissertation Soap, an eco-friendly soap business. You're listening to Lifestyles. I'm Lillian Vasquez. If you're just joining us, my guest now is Julie Reince. She's a mom and a CEO who created her own business while doing her doctoral research. And now she's a UC Riverside alum. Welcome to Lifestyles.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So the name of your business is Dissertation Soap. Clever name. Why did you start making soap? What was your original inspiration?
You know, I started making soap in grad school. I was purchasing handmade soap because I found out that it was very gentle on your skin, and my family had a lot of skin allergies, psoriasis, and eczema. My daughter especially was premature, so premature babies have very sensitive skin, and I was buying handmade soap, and a light bulb just went on one day where I thought, wait a minute, I'm a chemist. I can do this. I can make soap. So I started making soap out of my kitchen, just completely geeking out with chemistry and soil science and incorporating all of the things I learned during my graduate studies in mineralogy, soil science, water chemistry.
So you were the perfect person to start doing this. So tell me, take me through the process. What's the process and the ingredients you first started making your soap? And then how long does it take to make soap?
Well, it takes a lot longer than people realize. So the process of making soap is you take oils, and it's really the fatty acids in the oil. You combine them with a caustic substance like lye. It's a basic chemistry acid-base reaction, neutralization, where you combine an acid and base. They neutralize each other, and they become the salt, not the salt of the fatty acid. So become close to neutral, safe to use on your skin. Everybody's heard of fatty acids in oils.
Right.
So that's the acid part. And every oil contributes a different property to the soap. So it can add different types of lather or hardness, moisturizing properties. I looked at all of the fatty acid profiles, and I cherry-picked all the ones that I thought would be best for helping skin that had allergies or eczema, psoriasis, anything that would cause calm down inflammation. So I really, really geeked out on that. And then I have a serious passion for soil science and mineralogy covers that as well. And I just looked at all different types of clays that can be used on your skin and how they would interact on your skin. Sort of good understanding of how they react in the soil and with water. And you have to use water in order to wash your skin. That's how I learned how to use different clays in the soap.
I assume you're making bars of soap, not a liquid soap, right?
Correct. Yeah, bars of soap are a lot more moisturizing.
Huh.
They're better for your skin because you can, they call it a super fat content. Soap makers can choose a level of extra fat that doesn't neutralize. So it's like leftover fat in the soap. I use a really high super fat content. It takes a long time for the soap to cure because of it, but it's a very moisturizing bar of soap.
So let's talk about that. When you say it takes a long time for it to cure, are we talking hours, days, months? How long does it take for a bar of soap to cure?
Oh, well, once you make it, and it's a lot like baking. You make
okay.
the oils, you blend it with a stick blender, an immersion blender, pour it into a giant mold. I use a giant loaf mold, so it looks like a loaf of bread almost.
Okay.
I let that sit overnight at 24 hours. I unmold it a couple days later and let that sit. I cut it into bars of soap. And then from there, it takes anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks before the bar of soap can be used. And I have a whole quality control process that I use where I test the bars of soap with pH strips to find out to make sure that they're safe to use on your skin.
So I'm visualizing you in your home, in your kitchen, making like a baking thing, but you're making soap. Have you turned your house or your kitchen or some room into your business area, or how are you working that?
You know, I'm fortunate enough that I have a huge workshop now. I started off in my kitchen, and then looking back 5-6 years ago, I can't even imagine going back into a kitchen making soap again. Now I have almost like a little mini warehouse.
Nice.
That I work out of, and it is completely full. I can't imagine going back to the kitchen sink method, but I'm grateful that I had that starting point.
Sure. And like now, one of the things with soaps that I like, and I'm sure it's going to be a no-no, but I like fragrances. I like the soap to smell nice. But I'm sure that causes other flags for you. So tell me, do you have one type of soap and that's it?
Oh, no, I have several types of soap. Every soap addresses a special need or serves a purpose. I hired somebody, and we went through all the different types of soap. We counted about 19 different bars of soap that I make between custom orders and soap that we carry on our online shop. You know, we use scents, but we mostly use essential oils, which are biodegradable, a little bit more gentle on your skin. And I find that a lot fewer people are allergic to essential oils than to fragrance.
So when you're talking about purposes, what type of purposes would you be checking off?
When I design a bar of soap, I look at, first of all, if it's going to help what body part is going to be used for the soap. So if it's a face soap versus a body soap, I modify the pH a little bit for a face soap versus a body soap. And then if it has heavy exfoliators, I don't want that in a face soap either, because I only make soap for very sensitive skin, and abrasive things in the soap can really irritate your skin on your face. People don't realize that the pH very subtly changes on the different areas of your body, and that can affect what products you use. I mean, you want to have a good quality face soap that's separate from your body soap.
So take me back to when you first started. What did you learn? What do you know now that you didn't know then and you went, ah, darn, I wish I'd have thought of that then?
Oh, so many things. I never set out to be a business owner. But looking back, I always think if I did it all over again, I would do this, this, and this. I was a very reluctant business owner. I did not start making soap in order to sell it. I never, ever thought I would get to this point. So probably looking back, I would have probably put more into branding, more into the marketing side. I've just always viewed myself as a nerdy scientist, not really like into the business part, even though it naturally comes to me, thank goodness. But I probably would have put more into the branding and to getting my story out. I think in general, scientists can be kind of shy.
Now, when you were first creating your soap, you were working on your dissertation, right?
Yes.
And you didn't think that was a lot to be working on your dissertation, having a baby, and creating a business?
You know, it was a lot. I used my business as a source of creative outlet for me.
Okay.
So it started off as a hobby, and it was a way for me to create something. I was always used to having a lot of hobbies, gardening, sewing. I've always been a maker. Pottery has been a huge passion of mine. So I had all these hobbies, but I really couldn't do them and also balance other things. For some reason, soap just came naturally to me. I was able to work on it in steps. So because of the curing process, I would make it, and then I would leave it alone and walk away for a while. It was a good outlet for me and a good creative outlet,
cool,
I think, for to be able to get really creative with design, color, clays. I kept a notebook. I treated it just like my dissertation. I wrote everything down. I treated each batch of soap like as if it were an experiment.
Cool. Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Julie Rentz. She is the CEO of her own business, and the name of her business is Dissertation Soap. I love the name. Obviously, it was I shouldn't say obviously, but I'm guessing it was because you're working on your dissertation and that's why you came up with that name?
Partially. I also really didn't know what to call my soap company when I started it on Etsy.
Uh-huh.
But at the time, because I was an environmental science, I am still very passionate about repurposing and reusing. Our department was throwing away dissertations, old dissertations from the 40s and the 50s. So they were all hand typed up. And I started to wrap the bars of soap in those old dissertation pages.
Huh.
So I naturally just thought, well, why not just dissertation soap? Because it's wrapped in dissertation pages.
Very clever. Let me ask, what was your dissertation on, and are you working in that field as well, or has the soap just taken over and cleaning up shop?
You know, I work on the soap 100% right now, but I'm still publishing my dissertation. We just accepted a publication. My doctoral research was in avocado research, which was also a very fun topic. I still passionately love avocado research to this day. But I looked at irrigation management, soil chemistry, and nutrient management in avocados.
So avocado research, fill me in a little bit on that. I'm someone that doesn't like avocados. I'm probably
no
very,
problems.
Very...
I won't hold that against
okay,
you.
Okay, thank you.
I promise. Plenty of other people love avocados.
So why avocados, and what was your research about?
Well, avocados in California have a lot of challenges because of water shortages, and we've all heard of the drought. But also, California produces 90% of the avocados that supply the U.S.
Oh.
So there's a great demand for avocados from California, and they're very high-quality avocados. But there's also a lot of pressure from the irrigation, agricultural irrigation sector, balancing the demands of water between urban and agricultural use. Part of my project was looking at if we could reduce water use and how that would affect avocados.
Mm.
If For instance, if growers were already overwatering, if they could fine-tune their water technologies, so if they could install a sensor in the soil that could tell them when to water and how much, maybe they could reduce their water bill by enough so that would make them sustainable.
And wouldn't avocado growers probably be excited about less water, but be reluctant to give it a go?
Oh, I received nothing but a lot of support from the avocado growers. Part of my project was to give a survey. So I created a survey instrument and I distributed it to all of these avocado growers. And overwhelmingly, they were the most humble and nicest people I've ever met. They were just so grateful that somebody was out there trying to help them.
Oh, great. Can we grow avocados in our own backyard?
Yep, absolutely.
And do you have them in yours?
Just don't overwater.
Just don't overwater. Do you have them in yours?
I do have one avocado tree. I do. It doesn't really give me very many avocados. I think that it's the variety that needs another tree nearby to pollinate.
Oh, right. Let me ask you, getting back to your soap business. So in this pandemic, how's your soap business doing? Because it seems like soap's pretty important right now.
Yeah, it really has shifted my focus. I connect a lot more with the customers one-on-one. But overall, the sales have increased on the soap. But I started making hand sanitizer. Kind of reluctantly at first because I did not want to take advantage of anybody's fears, but it seemed very natural to do. I have a full chemistry lab and I had a lot of demand, a lot of people asking if I could make it. So I started making hand sanitizer and I added that to my line.
And do any of them have a avocado fragrance?
No avocado fragrance, but I do use avocado oil in almost every product, either avocado oil or avocado butter.
I believe you. Julie, thank you so much for sharing about your business and your dissertation soap, and good luck with that. Stay clean.
Thank you. Thank you for having me as a guest.
To learn more about Julie Rines and her dissertation soap, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles and click on today's show. That's our show for this week. To hear any of our past shows, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. You can also listen to Lifestyles on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Play Music. Search for Lifestyles with Lillian Vasquez on your streaming service and take this show on the go. If you have a topic or an idea for a segment, leave me a message at our website. Here it is again, kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. Stay tuned. There's going to be a quiz later. I'll be asking you if you can remember our website. Just kidding. Thanks to all who helped to make this show possible, including Sharina Wadd, David Fleming, Sean Houlihan, and executive producer Rick Dulock. Our theme music is provided by Ethan Bortnick. Join me next week at the same time for Lifestyles with me, Lillian Vasquez. Bye for now.
Yeah, the simple things in life.